The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, so I have a few announcements. One is that in the beginning of October, a couple of people connected to IMC, Judy Long and Jennifer Block, are each teaching here at IMC through the Sati Center, the compassion cultivation training that's been developed at Stanford. They've both gone through the teacher training there, and last year Jennifer offered it here, and that went well, and she's doing it again. And Jennifer is offering it, I think, on Tuesday afternoons, and Judy Long's going to offer it Thursday evenings for a small group. So, and you have to register for this, so you can find out more information, not on IMC's website, but on the Sati Center website. It's also flyers back there. I think it's an 8-week course. And then also, I said a few weeks ago that I would announce when the fundraising letter for our retreat center was available to be picked up, because maybe some of you voluntarily would pick up a fundraising letter. Imagine that. We had this great thing happen to us where the property next door to our retreat center in Santa Cruz County is a house next door and an acre of land. And it's the only really house next door. And so whoever lives there has a big impact on us. The person who lived there, an elderly lady, she loved us. She, when we moved in and opened up our retreat center there, she wanted to make a gate in the fence between the properties so she can come and meditate with us. And she said she used to, 40 years ago, when she first lived there on the property before anything was built on that, where the retreat center is now, she said, I used to walk around here and tell my husband, this would be a great place for a meditation center. So, and now it is. And she moved. And so she sold the property, was put on the market in May. And so we wanted to buy it, hoped to buy it, partly to protect the environment, having the house next door could have a big impact on us, but also to be able to strengthen the foundation for our retreat center. And we didn't have the money to buy it or to take out the loan. But to our wonderful surprise, a supporter who happened to be on the retreat when that came on the market, offered to buy it for himself and to hold it for 5 years while we raised the money to buy it from him. And so that's a very generous thing to do, and it works a little bit better in our kind of mindful time, you know, time frame. You know, real estate sometimes is you have to rush to buy it around here sometimes. So now our rush is 5 years. And so we started a fundraising drive, and there's a letter for Andrea Fella and I from us about this project and why it's such a great opportunity for us and such a great thing for our center. And so it's there by the door on the counter. So if you're interested in reading what we wrote about it, and if you're interested in supporting this project, take one of the letters. So today, I would like to begin an intermittent series of talks on what is called the Brahma Viharas, sometimes translated into English as the Divine Abidings. And these are, before I tell you what they are, I could tell you that they're quite important in Buddhism, because these are they're really at the center of the Buddha's message. And they're some of the key virtues, qualities of character, states of mind, and behaviors which are cherished and developed and in Buddhist practice. The word vihara means a dwelling or a place to abide. A Buddhist monastery is sometimes called a vihara. And Brahma is one of the great gods of the Indian pantheon. And it's said that this great god had four-faced head. I don't think he had four heads. He had four-faced head, like he used to. And he would, you know, survey the world from high up there in this heavenly realm. And depending on what was happening below, he would look with one of his faces. If someone was virtuous and doing wonderful deeds in the world, he would look with his face of goodwill and loving kindness, of metta. If someone was suffering, he would look upon that person or that event with the face of compassion. And if someone had success and healthy, good, wonderful success and happiness, he would look with his face of appreciative joy, of empathic joy. And then if there were circumstances where he could look upon people with all his goodwill, his love, his care, but there was nothing for him to do, nothing that he could do, perhaps, he would look upon them with a face of loving equanimity, equanimous love. And maybe you could imagine or visualize these four faces, each of them expressing a different sentiment, a different relationship, attitude of loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity. These are, I like to think of them as four forms of love, which are cultivated in Buddhism, that are part of Buddhist practice. And they are, I think, what makes the path of awakening, takes a path of awakening and translates it into our actions, into how we live our life. I think of it as, in certain circumstances, as quite liberal, or quite not liberal, but radical, revolutionary even, because it's calls upon us to take the path of opening the heart to freedom, to free the heart from what keeps it constricted, what keeps it divided between myself and others, take the path of liberation, which is the path of freeing us from greed and hate and delusion, freeing us from neurotic clinging to self, neurotic kind of or painful kind of separation of self and other, and transform that to a heart mind which is completely open and available to the world, present and free. And to express that, to live that in our relationship to the world. And it's revolutionary in that whenever in circumstances when people are divided, when we people live in opposition to each other, or we create a very strong separation between myself and others. And we know we live in a world of tremendous prejudice, discrimination, tremendous separation between people, some very conscious, some not so conscious. And these virtues, these practices of the Brahmaviharas are revolutionary in that as you do them, it's hard to kind of then keep living in a world divided between the rich and the poor and you know, all the ways in which we could divide ourselves, but you know, we become kind of open and available, open and present in a way that I think is transformative, not just for ourselves, but for our society. I hope it is. So the Buddha talked a lot about these four different Brahmaviharas, divine abodes. They're called, in English we say divine because they're the if you dwell with these states strong, then you dwell like Brahma. You dwell like this divine being. So they're divine abidings. There was once two Brahmins who came to the Buddha, and they wanted to know how to attain union, how to become one, I guess, with Brahma, this great God. And it's not a goal that other religions don't have. Some of them also have this idea of becoming one or having union with the God or the Godhead or something. And the Buddha said, well, I know how to do that. And then he taught them the meditation practices on each of these four forms of love. As you develop them as meditation practice, they become stronger and stronger. And they're so strong that when the samadhi is strong, your whole mental state, your whole inner mental state, is characterized by either loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, or equanimity. you take the samadhi, the mind that can completely be gathered together, absorbed, and focused on a single thing, and have it focused on love without any distractions, without anything gets in the way. And rather than the mind being limited, it's a mind which is said to be unlimited, boundless. Just and everything becomes love. Everything becomes is touched by one of these qualities of love. There's a radiance that people sometimes report they feel emanating from them when they sit established in these states quite strong. And so one of the names for these four, alternative name than the Brahma Viharas, that especially for those people who don't like gods, Brahmas of such things, they're called the boundless states, or the unlimited states, the apamana. And what's nice about this, they describe the feeling of how when these feelings of love are strong, they have no boundaries. Because a sense of boundaries that we have, we feel, are constructed by the mind. They're kind of concepts of perception the mind makes, that there's a limit to consciousness or awareness, to ourselves, to our body. And so when the mind relaxes deeply in samadhi, the construction of boundaries falls away, and the sense of awareness becomes more and more boundless. And when that boundless awareness is suffused by these love, the love feels boundless. It's quite a wonderful thing. My own entryway to these states was not through consciously practicing them, but rather from doing meditation practice. When I was a Zen student, I sat and opened myself up to be as present and fully as I could for whatever was happening. Kind of, I practiced unconditional acceptance for what was. And that kind of acceptance is one, what drops away, what's let go of, is anything that gets in the way of that acceptance, any of the non-acceptance, resistance, pushing away, wanting, holding on, all kinds of things which are not just being with what is. And so I was practicing being with what is, trying to at least, and the thing that I often had to be with in my early years, probably my first, I don't know, probably 7 years of practice, was I had a lot of suffering. And so I ended up being with suffering a lot. And that was great. I didn't know that at the time. At the time, I thought, you know, this is not so good. This is not desirable. But I was committed to sit with it. But why it was good was that the combination of being opening and being present and accepting, letting go of resistance, letting go of agendas, and just being very, very simple with suffering affected my heart. And it affected it so that what got developed in me was compassion. And I was very surprised by these strong feelings of compassion that welled up and started to be there in the kind of riding the waves of breathing in and breathing out. Riding the waves of awareness as it kind of radiated out into the world as I sat there and being present. And it felt very good. Compassion was one of the surprises, is compassion felt very, it was very satisfying to feel compassion. There's a feeling of warmth or of happiness almost that comes with pure compassion. And I think that's probably why the Dalai Lama has taught, one of his favorite teachings, that if you want to be happy, have compassion. Compassion is the foundation for happiness. And since then I've read that pure compassion, compassion that doesn't have any clinging or fear or distress associated with it, releases oxytocin. So, you know, you can get pretty good with that oxytocin stuff. And then when I started doing Vipassana practice, the practice we do here at IMC, I'd kind of worked through a fair amount of my suffering. So that wasn't really the operating kind of thing that I had to be present for. But as I was sitting, again, doing similar practice, just being mindful, being present for what's there, I was surprised that at some point what welled up was what I identified as a strong state of loving kindness, of metta, goodwill. And what surprised me there was very similar to the compassion. It's kind of very broad, boundless feeling that kind of radiated out from me. It seemed to be centered in my chest and just kind of flowed. And it felt very satisfying, very warm, very nurturing, just to have this way. And one of the things that surprised me was that it was love that had no object. Isn't that nice? Like many people think that love has to have an object, my beloved, my children, my family, whatever, my money, my car, my favorite restaurant, I love the food, you know, whatever, an object. But to have this boundless state, this boundless quality without an object was a great surprise for me, and to realize that this is a potential, that there can be strong states of love that are not conditioned or dependent on something in the world that stimulates it. It was very freeing, because then you could feel love without, you know, without having to be around your beloved or be around the thing that you love, or make, just relax and let go. It's more like relax and let go, and it's almost as if it's intrinsic to the heart to be loving. If you just get out of the way, if everything drops out of the way. And we see this in the teachings of the Buddha, that in some places he talks about once you let go of the hindrances, and once a few other conditions may be in place, like one of them is to start having a visceral, immediate experience for yourself of freedom, some degree of freedom from what you held on to, that the inspiration that comes from no longer having the hindrances, the inspiration that comes from realizing something true about the path of freedom, that that combination of letting go and inspiration, he says, leads to the arising of these four forms of love. So again, it doesn't not dependent on having an object here, but rather it's just something, intrinsic quality of how the heart operates under certain conditions. I would like to read to you so these qualities of metta, loving-kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity are referred to in the teachings of the Buddha as a form of wealth. And this, I quote, it's a wealth for a monastic. So monastics are not supposed to have any money. They're supposed not have any money. They're supposed to have just their robes and a begging bowl, very few possessions. And so if they can't have conventional wealth, what is wealth for a monastic? So the Buddha says, what is wealth for a monastic? Here, a monastic abides pervading the East with a mind accompanied with loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, or equanimity, and likewise pervades the South, the West, and the North, above, below, horizontally, everywhere, and all over pervades the whole world with a mind accompanied with loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, or equanimity, extensive, expanded, limitless, free from hatred and ill will. This is wealth for a monastic. So one of the great wealths that resides in your treasure house, it's there waiting for you, more or less. But it really is tapped into when you've learned not to be preoccupied by things. If you're preoccupied, there's no space for it. And oddly enough, if you're even preoccupied with your beloved or your hope-to-beloved or whatever, it gets in the way. Anytime you're preoccupied, it limits the free flow of awareness of the heart, of the sense of presence. You get contracted or focused or limited by what you're focused on. As the mind becomes more and more free, the mind is no longer preoccupied by things. And because it's not preoccupied, the mind is not limited by what it thinks about or what it's concerned with. If it's preoccupied, it's limited. It creates boundaries, limitations. So in Buddhist practice, these brahma-viharas are not left to chance. Love is not something that we just allow to exist the way it happens to be for us. We don't just say, well, it's there when it's there. It's chemistry, you know, and then it might be there. But rather, it's something that is cultivated and developed. And there's a variety of ways that that's done. One is indirectly, as I've described, by just doing meditation practice, it helps you relax and open up and drop the scales or the dust or the from the heart. The heart begins to kind of be tender, or open, and relaxed. The other way is to begin appreciating the different kinds of love that can exist when they do appear for us, and the appreciation of it can allow that which is healthy to grow and develop. And so the usual reference point for this kind of brahma-viharas is parental love. It's not amorous love. It's and it's kind of nice that it's parental love, because for most people in their lives, that was the first contact they had with love, was from their parents. And some of you have been parents, maybe you remember, if it went well enough, the birth, the first time you held your child and how you felt. And then they grew up. And things weren't so uncomplicated ever again. But, you know, I remember, you know, it was very, I remember my children being born. It was very touching when they were first born. And I remember when my wife saw my first son for the first time, she cried by seeing him. And so that's kind of the first experience that we don't remember we had, for many of us, is that we were touched, we were held, contact by a parent. And we grew up that way, and hopefully, if things went well, and there were parents who that loved us and cared for us. If we didn't have that, then it's very hard to be able to love oneself or love others as we grow up in its unlimited way, generous way. But it can be learned, it can be developed, and not too late. And then as we grow up, some of the next loves that happen, I think, or kind of close, warm connections often is with friends or family members or playmates or siblings or something. And so there's a, just kind of a natural thing that happens. And then as we get older, and then it becomes maybe partners and our children and all that. And this is kind of built into the human kind of system often for many people, is to have these primary relationship with people and sense of contact and connection, very important for us. What we try to do in Buddhist practice is to begin there, to appreciate what's already there, not to deny it in any way, but now to expand it and universalize it so that it's not limited to your family, to your tribe, to your clan, to your group, to, you know, the usual places, but learn to expand it and open it up so that it can become boundless, which means that we can encompass anyone and everyone in our goodwill, anyone and everyone in our care. And that becomes a practice. How do you do that? It's not easy to do that, but you have to want to do it. You have to be interested in doing it. And so Buddhism offers meditation practices you can do to develop that. There's a meditation practice specifically for each four of these kinds of love. And some of them are very systematic. It's amazing to have a very clearly developed systematic technique or approach to developing love. Isn't that great? You know, I know people who've tried for years at dating websites. You know, to see if that somehow the algorithm that they have there will help you discover love, you know, whatever that algorithm is that they're... algorithmic love. But I think it can be done faster than most of these websites. At least my friends who have tried it, it seems to go pretty slow. But a lot faster if you sit down and develop the meditation practice on love and, you know, spend that time, the systematic practices that are presented by Buddhism. But even more powerful than meditation practice is to be interested in or have a sense of what it means to have goodwill for others, to have a sense of what it's like to have compassion, to have a sense of what it's like to have appreciative joy in the joy of others, and have a sense of what it's like to have this equanimous love. And with that sense, or intuition, to begin seeing and exploring and stretching and how to have that in our active daily life. How to act from that. How to, so to have goodwill for others, goodwill is another translation for loving kindness, have goodwill for others and act on it. You know, so what would it be nice, what's it like to do a favor for someone, to be do a kind act, to do something that's a little helpful to someone? What's it like to be to offer compassionate care for someone who's sick? And to do it not out of obligation, but do it out of this beautiful quality of heart that can be there, and express it, stretch, explore. What's it like to do it here? What's it like to do it here? One of the great benefits I feel that I've received from my practice is that as I go about my days now, that's a constant reference for me. And so when I consider what am I going to say here or do here or how am I going to live, I refer back to what is the kind thing to do here? What would be goodwill here? How do I take this situation with care and compassion? What would love look like in this situation? And I wouldn't say that I do a great job at it. But I think that when I can't do it, and it's, you know, kind of feels uncomfortable and all that, but I'm kind of like happy too, because wow, I get to try. Isn't that nice? To have a life where you get to try to come this way and explore all this. So one of the protests that people have in this kind of teachings of the divine abode, these four forms of love, is that people protest and say, this sounds sentimental. It's unrealistic. And if I live this way, then I'm living a weak life, and there comes kind of a weakness, I'm a pushover, and I don't really, you know, I'm not really able to take care of myself, take care of my society, because we need to have rigorous truth-telling or rigorous kind of black and white, you know, fight for justice or something. And there might be some truth to that and how some people carry this goodwill within them. But I think that this is not what's going on. There's a number of conditions that really allow these loving kindness and compassion to really thrive within us. And one of them is confidence. And to develop a lot of confidence in oneself, to be able to sit upright and strong, metaphorically sit upright, be upright, to be able to walk into any situation and be grounded and stable and strong in yourself, to be able to know yourself really well, to know, be able to read and understand the situation well enough to not do things which would harm yourself or harm other people. Remember, the Buddha was a warrior. So one of the interesting questions in this reference point is, how does a warrior exhibit goodwill? How does a warrior, in the old days when warriors were kind of had certain nobility to them and honor, how does a warrior express kindness? A warrior express compassion or empathic joy? What kind of strength and capacity and presence does it call for? We don't have to diminish ourselves in expressing goodwill to others, but rather to be boundless, to be big and be present in a strong way. So be proud, almost proud. Proud maybe is kind of too limited, but be confident and, you know, let your chest be open and present. You don't have to assert yourself. Asserting yourself is just as bad as being self-effacing, but to be neither self-effacing nor asserting. Self-effacing is a kind of attachment to self. Asserting oneself is an attachment to self. To not be involved in self allows you to be confident and present in a strong way. So that kind of strength and confidence makes it easier for love to flow freely, because you don't feel threatened by what goes around you. You don't feel so easily threatened by opening your heart and taking someone in and feeling and being present for someone. A lot of people feel threatened by their own love. If I love this person, if I'm kind to this person, then the person will take advantage of me, will get too close to me, and want too much from me. There's two stories from the Buddha of two men who came to see the Buddha who were angry with the Buddha. And the first story was the Buddha did nothing during that but practice loving-kindness toward the angry man. And by the time he left, he had relaxed and his anger was gone. Just being kind. And I've seen that over and over again, that there's a kind of... I'll tell you another other story of similar, that the Buddha had an enemy named Devadatta, who was kind of trying to take over the Buddhist order and from the Buddha. At some point, Devadatta arranged for a military elephant who was used to going into battle to go and charge the Buddha on the street and kill him. And apparently this elephant was barreling down the street, and everyone, kind of all the people in that town, just kind of got out of the way and told the Buddha, get out of the way, run. And he refused to run. He just stood there in the middle of the street, like John Wayne, I guess. radiated his loving kindness towards the elephant. And as the story, probably a myth, goes, as the elephant came to the Buddha, it slowed down and then came to a stop right in front of him, the Buddha, and kneeled down in front of him. The Buddha kind of patted him. And so maybe it's a myth, but there's a kind of a unseen world that we live in. We don't always see where the effect of these things, how they actually work, the cause and effect relationships between things. And I've seen many times that when I have shifted my relationship to other people to one of goodwill, even if they they're not in my presence, when I finally go and see them again, something has shifted in our relationship. It was strained, but something changed. And what happened? I haven't seen them. Why did things change? Did it have to do with my developing goodwill towards them, or was it a coincidence? What happened? I went whale watching a couple of weeks ago here in Monterey, and we saw the humpback whales, which are out now, and it was great. And the naturalist who took us out in the boat described the humpback whales as their friends to all species. And then she described how the humpback whales will play with other animals in the ocean and also protect other animals. When the orcas come along, the humpback whales will get between the orcas and their prey and protect them in a variety of ways. They have all this care for other species. Maybe because they're mammals. Maybe this oxytocin thing, is a mammal thing. And we're kind of hardwired for care and compassion in some way. So anyway, I'm going on and on. So the Buddha, one angry man came to the Buddha and he just expressed his loving kindness, and that changed the man. Another man came to the Buddha and was angry with him. And then what the Buddha did was he said, ask your question. If someone comes to your house with a gift and you refuse to take the gift, who does that gift belong to? And the man said, oh, if a person doesn't take it from me, then it still belongs to me. And the Buddha said, in the same way, I don't accept your anger. It stays with you. Isn't it clever? Yeah. So, was he still being unkind in the second example and, kind in the first one? Probably he recognized there was a difference between the two angry men, and each of them called for a different response. And the second one who came, he held his ground in a certain way, and countered it and met it in a strong way, and you know, kind of pushed it back in a certain way. So this thing about you know, the goodwill, it doesn't mean we become a pushover. It doesn't mean that we have to kind of, every circumstance we're in, have to kind of embrace and hold the difficult situation. But I found over and over again to this day that coming into situations with relationships where I find challenging, and privately in myself, considering where am I closed? Where am I held up? Where am I resisting what's going on? Where am I judgmental? What is it like? Where can I find a way to be, to have my heart open, to be able to be present here in a confident and open and relaxed way, and meet the situation with goodwill or with care, to be friendly to the situation? And I find that it stretches me, it develops me, it cultivates me, and I feel like it actually does more for me to develop my loving kindness, my goodwill and compassion than doing it, this practice in meditation. I don't do the meditation practice on these things very often, but when I do it, I love it. It's so nice to sit here and kind of sit here and be able to spend 45 minutes or however long I meditate focusing on love. I mean, isn't that pretty lucky? Huh? Wow, you get to do that? And it's a good thing to do. So there are a lot of benefits that come from doing these practices. Some of them are beneficial for us personally. Here's a list of them. If you have strong loving kindness, you will sleep happily, you will wake happily, you will have no bad dreams. You'll be loved by others, and you'll be loved by non-humans, by the elephants that come charging. And here's an interesting one. It doesn't say you'll be loved by the devas, by the gods, the angels or whatever the devas are. One is guarded by the devas. Isn't that nice? One protected. Right? There's kind of an unseen protective force that comes when you enter into a place with goodwill and friendliness. And then it gets a little bit more far-fetched. Fire, poison, or sword won't touch you. Isn't that nice? Yeah, your fire didn't touch you. One's mind becomes concentrated quickly. One's complexion becomes clear. We should open up a beauty salon. The Brahma Vihara salon. It will do guided meditations for people. One dies with a mind free from confusion. And if no higher attainment is reached, one is reborn together with Brahma, Brahma's realm. So no higher attainment means that with a basis of love, the basis of these four loves, one doesn't then take it one step further and have insight that frees the mind completely. And so if you don't take it that next step, then that strong love that's cultivated and developed, they say here in the ancient school, you get to get reborn in your next life in the heavenly realm with Brahma. I don't know if you'll have four faces, but you get to live with this person who has four faces. So that's an introduction to the Brahma Viharas. And the Dharma practice days, which are these once a month on Friday practice days that we have here, the theme for this year will be these Brahma Viharas. And we'll spend 2 months on loving kindness, 2 months on compassion, 2 months on appreciative joy, and 2 months on equanimity. And then somewhere around the time of month where these Dharma practice days are happening, on Sunday I'll give a talk of each of these as we go along to kind of support the Dharma practice days. And for those of you who don't come to Dharma practice days, you'll get a little flavor of it as we go along. And so each of you are mammals, and as mammals, as with our relatives, the humpback whales, you also can become a protector of all species, all beings. You also have bodies that produce oxytocin. You also have capacity for being open-hearted. You also have the capacity to be friendly, to be kind, to be compassionate. Look for where it's easy for this kindness and compassion to exist for you, where it's easy to have it. Whether it's for your pet or for your relatives or for, if it's easiest with total strangers, if it's easy to do it in the abstract, because people are complicated, but in the abstract they're not, look for where it's easiest and begin exploring it and getting to know it. Get more familiar with it. Spend time with it. Live with it. And see if you can begin expanding where you spread, where you extend those good feelings out into the world. And it's a playful thing, experimental thing. There's absolutely no need to say to yourself that, oh, I can't do this. Of course, everyone can do it, if nothing else, as an aspiration. And don't underestimate how powerful and transformative it is to aspire to love. That begins the process of opening the heart up. So experiment with that. Play for it. Play around. Make it part of your life. You'll get wealthy. Really wealthy. The investment is really good. So thank you all very much.